So top line for all those companies right now are just about hitting 9 million in terms of revenue. But the goal for me is I'm not flipping these companies. I'm not growth at all costs, like a VC mentality. My whole focus is get good cash flowing, solid businesses that are operating in industries that are recession resistant, have recurring revenue, have some type of barrier to entry, and collecting them.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
Ben Kelly, what is up, brother? How are you?
I'm doing well, man. How are you doing today?
I am doing good. I can't breathe. Who needs breathing? Like, I don't need to breathe, eat, sleep, drink, water. Like, I'm good. Yeah. We're machines, man. We're entrepreneurs.
That's right. We just do the grit every day, all day. That's what we
do. Just grind or die, baby. Man, no, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You've got an awesome Instagram account that I follow, and I'll put that in the show description as well for people to go. But man, you're crushing it. There's a really cool niche that's emerging, which is this whole business buying sphere. And I think that business buying is just an absolutely wonderful asset class. I talk about it as well. We teach on it too. We got a bunch of business buyers in our squad and Action Academy. So I love meeting other people that are doing this thing and that are actively preaching on it, because it's few and far between. Because I feel like today, small business world is what real estate was post 2008. So I know you have so many ideas on all of this, but before we get into it, man, who is Ben Kelly for people that are listening to this and they've never heard of you before?
All right. Great question. So I'm Ben Kelly, and I buy six-figure cash flowing businesses as my main focus. And I teach others how to do it as well. And I run a group that does it. And so it's been a wild last 5 years. I started almost 5 years ago, acquired 7 companies. And now I have over 300 students doing exactly the same thing. So that's been awesome.
Sweet. Dude, 7 companies. Are you able to share what your top line revenue or what your take home is from that today? Because like 7 companies, this is insane, especially over 5 years.
It's been crazy. And so top line for all those companies right now are just about hitting 9 million in terms of revenue. But the goal for me is I'm not flipping these companies. I'm not growth at all costs, like a VC mentality. My whole focus is get good cash flowing, solid businesses that are operating in industries that are recession resistant, have recurring revenue, have some type of barrier to entry, and collecting them. Just collecting them and collecting the cash flow and continuing to do it. So that's what we're doing.
I love it, man. Yeah, I was immediately about to say, so yeah, you're about that 900 to 1.2 range per business. I'm assuming you're buying like smaller headcount, probably 2 to 4 headcount for these.
Yeah, some of them are around the 2 to 4 headcount. I would say the biggest one I have in terms of headcount is going to be around the 15 mark would be the biggest.
And that's sweet, man. Yeah, I'm excited to dive into all of this. But first and foremost, maybe somebody is just now tuning into the show for the first time and they're hearing us talk about buying businesses and they think that's super, that is what advanced investors do. Could never be them. So let's talk a little bit about why invest in businesses at all and then how you got into the space to begin with.
Yeah, great, great. So how I got into the space was I was an Army intelligence officer for 6 years. And as I was getting out, I got my MBA like all officers are supposed to do. And you're supposed to go work for corporate America for the rest of your 20 years and then retire. And so I got out, did the MBA thing, and got hired by JP Morgan and went to their private bank. And so I was making good money and I was enjoying the job. And I realized after about a year and a half of working in the private bank, and we're dealing with usually business owners, but it doesn't have to be a business owner, but people who have net worths, we're talking in like the 9-figure range. So these are very wealthy individuals. And so we are managing a bunch of these clients and their wealth. And I noticed that some of these clients were literally doubling, sometimes tripling their net worth in a year. And I was like, what is going on? What are they doing? And so I would talk with them and they would talk about their strategies. And now they were buying and acquiring businesses. Obviously, these businesses were much larger than ones that I'm doing at this moment. But they would go and acquire a business that was doing 50 million top line and it had another 10 million in EBITDA, right? And they would acquire these, fold it underneath their portfolio and just continue to cash flow and move on and keep on doing it. And so I saw this happening on a big scale. And I was, and it, after a year and a half, it really just dawned on me, what is stopping me from trying to do this on a smaller scale? And so went out there on YouTube, read books, buy then build by Walker Dive, like just went down the rabbit hole and tried to learn as much as I possibly could. And it took me 18 months and banging my head against the wall, trying to figure out how to do this. Had a bunch of mistakes, had a bunch of things that wish I could have gone better. And then finally got my first deal done, which was a software company, a SaaS company. And since then, that kind of proved the concept to me. It did well, moved on and continued to acquire businesses. And I got better and better at it. Banged my head against the wall less and less times to the point where now I have a pretty good strategy for doing what I'm doing. So
awesome. So why business? Somebody's listening to this and they're like, huh, that's interesting, Ben. I too make six figures in my job. And I'm looking at these rental properties and I'm realizing that even before today's interest rates, if I were to successfully complete a BRRRR project or something, I'm getting $200 to $300 of cash flow per property. And then maybe I'm doing multifamily and then the cap rates are going crazy. Maybe I'm doing self-storage and it's not getting the cash flow that I wanted. And I'm confused because I heard real estate was supposed to get me cash flow. So What are you talking about these businesses? Why business?
Yeah, yeah, that is the question, right? Because most of your listeners probably, like, again, they're entrepreneurial. They've probably gone down the real estate rabbit hole and they've gone down all these different types of avenues for generating cash flow. And there is no other asset class out there that will perform like a good, solid, recession-resistant, recurring model business. And the reason is that the multiples in which you are buying these businesses are much smaller than what you're doing on real estate. Okay. So use an example. If you're going to go out and you're going to buy, let's say, a $500,000 house, and you're going to take that house and you're going to rent it out. And so you buy it, you make sure that whatever the mortgage payment, all the taxes, all that good stuff, that you can still rent it on. If you do an annual rental, you got to make sure that the obviously the amount that you're getting in rent exceeds the amount in expenses. And hopefully you're making a delta of, let's call it $300-$400 a month. At the end of the year, you're making around $3,500, $4,000 for your total investment on $500,000. Now, I know you use leverage, got it, but that's what you're looking at in terms of cash flow. So if we take that same example, we throw out and we try to find a $500,000 business, something that's around $500,000. Now, the way the businesses are structured, they're on a multiple basis. So you're looking at a low end, a 2x multiple on cash flow, or on a kind of a high x, 4x multiple. Now, there's different industries that have different multiples, but for the most part, that's the multiple range. And so now you take the same example, $500,000 business. Let's just put it on a 2x multiple. That means that business has to be making right around $250,000 in cash flow, right, to be able to get to the $500,000. Now, also, if it's a 4x multiple, now you're looking on the low end, maybe it's doing around 125, 150K on the low end, right? Mm-hmm. So now we're talking, instead of a couple grand a year in terms of cash flow, now we're looking at six figures a year in cash flow. Now, I know some of you out there are probably thinking, running a business is, that's a lot harder than if I have real estate, it's passive. Every real estate investor knows it's not completely passive, right?
Correct.
For your renter. Now, it might be more passive than a business, and it depends on how you structure that purchase. And the way that you're able to have more than one, two, three, seven, and some people out there are now in dozens of acquisitions, is they're structuring these deals in a way where they're not running the day-to-day, okay? And so you're able to go out there, find these great businesses, find partners, utilize leveraging the financing that's available, and be able to structure deals in a way where you walk away making a 200-400% return year one on the cash you've invested while you're still not running the day-to-day. And that is where that sweet spot is hit between the two strategies.
I have a contrarian take of the contrarian take, and I would like for you to validate it or to tear it apart. If you're up for this game, if you want to play this with me.
Totally, totally up.
So I am 1,000% with you in the macro. I think that if you're buying real estate, especially if you're like, because this is the world that we live in too. So I'm like, we help people buy commercial real estate and businesses. So it's just like somebody's got a couple of Airbnbs, they got a couple of like long-term single family rentals, and they want to get into multifamily, right? They want to buy like a 40 unit or a 60 unit or a 100 unit. And then they immediately want to hire a property manager to come in and manage the thing, correct? You go ahead and get the team, or they want to buy this 6-person headcount HVAC company, a small headcount service company or something. And they immediately, their first thought is, let me hire the operator to come in, take this thing over, and I'll put the deal together, all this good stuff. I believe that, and again, confirm or deny this, I believe that for the first acquisition, at least for a solid like 6 months, it's probably better for you to manage the thing first and then hire it out for the next couple of ones. But I just see a lot of people that have never managed anything, never led a team, and they're all of a sudden buying a team of 8 people and they're just like, oh, somebody else is going to handle this. And so that's my idea. If you're going to buy a 30 unit or a 50 unit, manage the thing at least for a couple of months, learn the ins and outs of it yourself, then delegate it out. And then you have like insider baseball, like trench level knowledge. I'm curious about your perspective on that.
Oh, totally makes sense. And you're correct in the way that you have that, you're intuiting that it is not as simple as, and especially, okay, and I'll do some caveats.
I'm just going to hire a rockstar operator.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the way that, there's two different ways to look at this. The larger the business, the easier it will be in general.
Ironically.
Post-acquisition. The smaller the business, so now let's say the difference between buying a $500,000 business and a $5 million business is you're definitely going to probably be more involved post-acquisition in the $500,000 business for a longer period of time to get it to the point where you have an operator in there running the day-to-day and you can step back from it. Then you are a $5 million business that already has 3 levels of management and a full-on team, a CFO, everything else that are really managing almost every aspect of the company. Hmm. And this is why private equity groups, they go after larger companies. They go after $10 million plus companies because at the end of the day, they're not running the day-to-day. They want to inherit a team that is doing that, and now they're going to pour money in, increase marketing, make more money, and that's their game plan. So we want to take that approach that we're not dealing with $10 million plus companies. We're dealing with, for the most part, between 1 and 5 million is where everyone is operating, at least my students and where I'm operating at.
The retail investors.
Yeah, exactly. So we are looking at hundreds of deals before we get really one or two that qualify for what we're looking for. Now, there are certain industries out there where you're absolutely correct. No matter what's really any deal you're looking at, if you buy it, you're buying a job at least for the first half a year, if not more, until you're able to find someone, train them up, and have those systems and processes in place to make sure that you are not doing a full-time job. So that is very good. Now, there's other industries that are more friendly to an acquisition where the way that they're structured inherently makes it much easier, for one, for remote management, as well as the way the teams are structured and incentivized, it's much easier for the manager not being day to day or the owner being day to, and you can get away with an operations manager or a GM who's doing it. So in general, you're absolutely correct, which is why we're super, super picky in the businesses that we're going after. And it's not just that you're going to make a lot of money. There's a lot of deals out there where you'll make money, but it all depends, like going back to the beginning of, I'm always optimizing for my time. That's something that I'll never get back. It's a finite thing. And so for me, I look at a deal, both are making me, let's say, $500,000 a year. I'm going to go towards the one who's going to be way less time on my part, even if the growth prospects are much less, even if it's less sexy, even if there may be less opportunity, I'm going to go with the one that optimizes for my time.
And I think that's so important to point out, because you are very clear. You have 3 young kids. You're very clear about what life you want to live. So can you elaborate a little bit for somebody that is maybe seeking to take the leap into business acquisition or even like large real estate deals? Like, we always try to recommend, hey, what do you want? What's a perfect day for you? Like, what's a perfect week for you? Can you cover what that is for you and your process and going about that before you started the acquisition?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, as I just mentioned, time is a finite asset that all of us are, every single day, we're losing more of it. And so we were joking about this at the beginning, but it's very easy to get caught into the grinding mindset as an entrepreneur, right? Because me and you and probably a lot of your listeners, they control their daily schedule, right? And so if you have something to do, guess what? You got to do it. There's no one else out there to do it. You're going to do it. You're going to burn the midnight oil. You're going to work and you're going to get it done. Now, it's cool when you can control your schedule, because guess what? I'm not working today. I'm going to do something else. Great. But guess what? The things that you didn't do today didn't get done. And now you got to figure out a way in which you're going to get those things done. So it's easy as an entrepreneur to get stuck in that trap of trading time for money. And so the way we go about it is, how do we make it to where I'm not trading my time for money? How do I try to make it to where I put maybe some initial time in to get this thing going? And then I'm able to step back largely to where my time is not directly equals out what I'm getting in compensation. And so for me, the way my day looks and my week looks is, my kids, I have three kids. I got a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old now. And so the 4 and 3-year-old, they go to school from 9 to about 2. And so for me, I wake up in the morning, help them get ready to school. They go off to school. I do the things that I want to do in terms of, if I want to go work out, I get a workout in, I come back home, take a shower, jump in front of my computer by 10. And I'm trying to be done with 4 to 5 hours a day in work. And I'm able to really focus. And it's about also getting quality work done. A lot of people will say they work for 10 hours a day, but they really didn't work for 10 hours. They worked for maybe half that. And the other time was just spent watching cat videos or whatever, YouTube, the rest of the time and not focusing. And so for me, when I'm at work, I work. And then when I'm not at work, I turn it all off. I turn off notifications. And when my kids walk through the door, I try to be as present as I possibly can with them. And that is able to, one, stop me from getting burnt out, because could I have worked another 5 hours that day? Absolutely. There's a bunch of projects I could have spent probably another 10 hours working on those projects. But for me, at the end of the day, and I know that you had a previous guest on, the author of The 18 Summers and that family board meeting, and he was talking about how you're able to now look back. I never want to look back and say, that extra million I made was so worth it that I didn't get to see my kids, right? Like, there's no amount of money that's going to make that time be missed worth it. And so for me, it's optimizing. So I try to work 4 to 5 hours a day, and I'm really locked in during those time. And then I'm always trying to make sure when the kids get home, I'm going out there, I'm playing with them, I'm pouring into them. I make sure that every summer when the kids are off school, for instance, this summer, we're going to be in Italy for almost 2 months, right? So we're going to go out there. And the cool thing with the time change during the day, I'm with them 100%, right? They go to bed, I'll work then for my 3 to 4 hours. And so it works out really well where I'm able to do that. So I'm trying to maximize the time I have. And there's always ways in which I can work longer and harder, make more money. But at the end of the day, that's not the end goal that I'm looking for on that end.
And I think that's important, because guys that are listening, guys and girls, pay attention to what Ben just said, because he was intentional about the type of life that he wanted to live. And for him to go take his family to Italy for 2 months in the summer and to have time with his kids from 10 to 2 or 9 to 2, like, that is so important, because it could directly dictate your buy box with what asset you're acquiring.
Right.
And it allows you to say no easier. And that's where the dollars are in all the no's. Because it's all about, you don't want to buy something. You're like, congratulations, I bought a business. And then you're like, wait a second. Now I just traded 40 hours a week for 100 hours doing this. I've had so many friends do that. And they're like, I did the thing. Somebody tagged Cody Sanchez on Instagram. I did it. And then they're like, wait a second. Why am I in this laundromat right now painting these walls and installing these mirrors and fixing these machines? Because my employee just quit. Wait, what? I thought this was supposed to be passive. You said something there that was really interesting. And I think I want to add some even more like pain to it, which is, you said in 5 hours a day that somebody can say that they're working 10 hours a day and maybe you're watching cat videos or something. Mm-hmm. It's actually even worse than that, because I don't think most people that are listening to this are actually like scrolling endlessly through TikTok or anything like that. But you are still working on the business, and I am raising my hand guilty that there are so many things in my world that I have not yet delegated, that is just busy work in my business that has the appearance of work. And you can think that you're working and being productive, which is even worse. Because the cat video, you're like, I'm being an idiot. But instead, you're like, I'm replying to all these emails. I'm booking all these appointments. I'm setting all these calendar invites. I'm doing all this admin work. And yesterday, my team just made their first sale without me.
Oh, that's a great feeling. That's a great feeling.
And it happened. Like, the call was on the calendar. They spoke with them about what we do without me. And more than anyone, it's like, when you build your own business, you're everything. Like there is no passive. Like it is the most active. You are head of marketing, head of sales, head of fulfillment, head of legal, head of finance. And this is the first time I've done 1,000 sales calls myself. It's the first time that it's been done without me. And that's so important. So
yeah,
just wanted to hit on that. So let's talk about your buy box for these businesses, because that's so important with you and your students and what you're doing. So what businesses are home runs for you? What businesses are absolute red flags? And you're like, stay away from this one at all costs if you want to have any semblance of freedom.
Yeah, I'll start off there actually, because that's probably one of the most common questions I get from people who join my program. And okay, so what should I buy and what shouldn't I buy? And more of an emphasis on what shouldn't I buy? Because you're wasting time when you're looking at those types of deals. And there's a couple that I would say just stay away from. And again, this is general advice. So if you're into this type of business, don't get hurt. Oh, Ben doesn't like my business. It has nothing to do with that. Just for the most amount of people, this is good advice. So one is stay away from anything that is tied to new construction. Okay. Hmm. Now I say this, obviously right now we're in a downward cycle when it comes to new construction, because obviously rates are high and those construction companies are getting hurt. Right now, they are very much a cyclical business. They're very boom or bust, right? So when times are good and rates are low, these guys are cranking out money. They're living a good life. When rates are high and the market turns, they're the first ones to lose their shirts, right? And so because construction times are they're very much lagging. So it takes, let's say in some areas, a year to complete the project. So they get a payment. And then a year later is when they actually produce the product. A lot changes in a year. Right? Fed goes and raises rates, all these things change. And before you know it, the waiting list that they had is now people are backing out and it can change really quickly. So anything to do with new construction in directly or indirectly. So if your business where your number one customer is home builders, and this could happen for HVAC or plumbing. And I always tell people who are going after those industries, those are great industries, make sure that your number one customer is not home builders, right? Make sure it's residential or commercial, a much safer and more resilient base of customers and clients than the home builders, which can give you a huge and a ton amount of business in a short period of time and things are good. And then all of a sudden they cut off your contract because guess what? They had a bunch of cancellations on their wait list and they don't need you anymore, right? And now 80% of your revenue was tied up in that. And now you're like, wow, okay, now I have to pivot quickly. I have to lay people off and it's just a hard thing. So new construction. The second one that I would say stay away from is really anything that is, and this is for first-time acquirers and people that are just getting into this, stay away from something that's project-based. And the reason why I say this is because it is, one, those types of companies are, there's a reason why the multiples are always nicer because they're less valuable. And we'll get into why. Always try to go for something that's recurring or as much of the revenue is recurring. Okay. So project-based are things where you're going out there and this, let's say HVAC, for example, which I think is a good industry. But if all your revenue is coming in from going and installing a system, okay, that system is once you might get a nice $10,000, $15,000 payment up front. Great. Now you have to find a new customer to do that with, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, install the new system and get them on a maintenance contract, right? That's a yearly maintenance contract. They pay a couple $100. You go out there a couple times a year, you do maintenance on it, and you sell them on upgrades. You sell them on different services. And it's a way for that customer to not just be one-time revenue source. Now they are a recurring revenue source. And if an HVAC company has good amount of revenue coming in from maintenance contracts, their value is much higher than something that's just doing those project-based one-time hits. Okay.
Correct.
And I would tell everyone, stick away from 100% coming from projects and stick away from construction nor new construction. And if you avoid those two, that is going to put you into a category where now you're focusing on more recession resistant businesses, regardless of what's going on in the macroeconomic environment. These are services that are going to be needed. So focus on those. Focus on ones that also offer a recurring service and they get most of their revenue coming from something that's recurring. And then the last thing is make sure that the business you're looking at has some kind of barrier to entry.
Moat.
Has a moat around it. And a good example would be a landscaping company. Landscaping companies can have a moat when they're of a certain size, because at that point they can do jobs that smaller guys can't do, like an HOA community. But if you're trying to buy a small landscaping company for $100,000, or $200,000, guess what? anyone can start up a landscaping company tomorrow. They don't need a license. They just need a mower. They go out and knock on the door and just undercut you on price. And guess what? They have your customer. And so get away from racing to the bottom type businesses, which is, so go for something that has scale or something that has a moat built around it to where it's hard to compete against.
John Warlow has a wonderful book called Built to Sell.
Yep.
Yeah. And he talks about that a lot, where I think he even used the analogy of an HVAC technician company or an HVAC company, where he was just like, the multiple is like 99 cents valuation for one-time revenue, but then it's like $1.99 for every dollar of recurring revenue. And so that literally, interviewing him and having him on the show, and he coached me for 2 hours afterwards, which was, shout out to John, it changed my entire business. Because we started as an online course, and I was like, wait a second, this is terrible. So now we're recurring. All of our revenue is recurring, and it makes for a much better business. So to recap what you said, so stick away from new builds, anything that's reliant on industries that are fluctuating a lot with the economy. So we don't want that. We want like that inelastic. Make sure that there's a barrier to entry, and make sure there's a recurring revenue component. And if there isn't, then don't do it. I'm curious, this is a trend that I'm seeing, and I understand how it's happening, but nobody's really talking about it. So I really want to pick your brain on this. So real estate, and I think this is the issue. Real estate, you buy problems in real estate. So the crappier the house, the shittier the house, the worse the experience. If it's a crack house, you're like, this is awesome. This is money. This is a good deal. I'm going to come in and fix this. People, you're smiling. You already know where I'm about to take this.
Yeah.
People then use that same philosophy when it comes to buying businesses. And they're like, give me this failing business with the worst management and all this stuff. I'm going to be the one to change it. I'm going to come bring in the systems and the processes, and I'm going to fix this and bring it back to life. I think that's the worst thing you could possibly do. And I'm curious about your perspective on this.
Yeah, I think you can guess my perspective on that. So I 100%, anyone who's ever come to me and said, hey, I can get this screaming deal, like they're selling for less than 1x multiple on cash flow. It makes more cash flow than what they're saying they're selling at price. I'm always like, just leave it alone and walk away. There are some people out there that have a skill set where they can do that. And that is very rare. It is tumultuous. It is drama filled. It is not fun. And they do it because they make a lot of money, but it's also extremely hard to do, right? And so for 99.9% of us out there, don't ever go down that road. What you want to do is buy something that is consistently generating profits year over year, has a long, consistent track record, has a great customer base, and has great reviews. That is, even with all those things, it's still going to be upward to continue to grow that company. So even when the foundation is solid, it's still going to be an effort, right? So when that foundation is cracked or crumbling or it's built on sand, it is extremely difficult. So to your point, absolutely. In businesses, when you see something that is on fire, you let it burn to the ground. You don't get involved. You walk away and you find something that's been around and it's done well. Other question, I know I didn't get to the point of what kind of businesses do we want to buy? A couple of examples of that. So we talked about the ones that we didn't want. I'll say just on the top. So obviously we already went over the three characteristics that we're always looking for: recession resistance, recurring revenue, and a barrier to entry. Some of the ones that really fit into that well that a lot of our students actually get into, believe it or not, is probably the number one business that my students are buying right now is accounting firms. And it
makes
sounds
sense.
Yeah, exactly. So we hit the recurring revenue, we hit the recession resistance, and we hit the barrier to entry. And one of the other reasons why people see them as a great deal is, and I just actually acquired one in December, so I'm part of this group, is you're getting them at a very good price, because accounting firms are one of the businesses and industries that don't go off the 2-4x multiple for cash flow. They sell on pretty much 1x revenue of the previous year. And gross.
Really?
So yeah. So for instance, and we'll go into how this works out in the numbers, a typical accounting firm, especially one that's doing $5 million or less in revenue, a good one is doing around 40, sometimes up to 50% cash flow.
Profit margins.
Because again, it's very much a skilled labor. A lot of white collar services have those higher margins. So they're making that. So if an accounting firm does $1 million in revenue, they're walking away with potentially up to $500K in cash flow, right?
Mm-hmm.
That same business, if it was an HVAC business, would sell for at least 3x, if not 4x. So now that business would be $1.5 to $2 million to buy that HVAC business, but you can buy that accounting firm for $1 million, right? So you're buying, getting way more bang for your buck in terms of cash flow to the price that you're getting. And one of the great things about accounting firms is that because taxes are every year and bookkeeping is every month, it takes a lot for people to fire their accountant. It's very sticky because one, people hate dealing with it. And so as long as your accountant has done a decent job and filed your taxes and you're happy with how that's looking, people don't want to go through the annoyance of going to find someone else and transferring all their financial records and doing all that. They have a typical accounting firm, like they're keeping 96 to 90% of their customers, not because they're awesome at customer service. It's just because it's such a hard thing to switch, right?
Barrier to entry. So, there's the moat.
Yeah, exactly. So it hits all of those, on the mechanisms that we talked about before. So that is probably one of the most popular ones. I think just in the past 3 or 4 months, we probably had about 7 students close on accounting firms. It's definitely one of the more popular ones to mention.
I love that. And to hit on what you said before, how I learned all of this stuff and exactly what you said was don't buy problems, buy opportunities.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just don't buy something that's screaming and like the ship that's sinking and try to patch a hole in the Titanic. Buy the cruise ship that's going and they don't have Wi-Fi and they don't have any entertainment. And you're like, oh, I can add this because they're lazy and they're just like hanging. Yeah. But I knew about the CPA firms and the accounting firms because I've had 2 CPAs in the last month on this show that are both netting $1 million take home from doing that same strategy.
Yeah,
I'm curious, when you're looking at trailing cash flow, how many years are you looking at in profit when you're analyzing a business? Is there a certain metric that you're looking at?
Yeah, so we're looking at least 3 years. So they have to have at least 3 years. We'll look at it further, but 3 years is what I'm really paying close attention to.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I always like validating things that I hear, and then you hear them over and over again, and you're like, yes, okay, cool, that checks out. Can you talk about why that's important?
Yeah, absolutely. So any business can have an amazing year, right? A lot of it doesn't even sometimes mean that they have a great business. It just means that they were at the right place at the right time. Macroeconomically, something could have happened. COVID happened. Some businesses suffered greatly. Some skyrocketed in revenues because they had a service that people needed during that specific time. And so you never want to just look at a business in the scope of 12 months, right? So you always want to extend that timeline out at least 3 years and you'll start to see a trend. Right now, you have enough data points that can point to where that business is going. And so 3 years, you want to get tax returns, you want to get P&Ls. And as you get under contract, at that point, you're looking at bank statements. You're looking back years in bank statements. You want to reconcile what they're telling you on the P&Ls and making sure it's matching what's actually going on in the bank statements. And then after all that, you got to make sure that it matches the tax returns, because even though you can buy a business without a bank, you can do seller financing, you can have investors, it makes it much cleaner and easier when they're actually saying they're making that much money and it's proven by the tax returns, right? And so or at least getting close enough to where it's easily to reconcile them. A lot of businesses get in trouble. And this happens with, as you mentioned before, laundromats and other cash-based businesses that are hard to get lending on because they get paid in cash. They don't show all their profit on their tax returns. And they say they only made $10,000 a year on their tax returns, but now they're trying to sell the business and saying they're making $300,000. And so now if you have in a bank, they're going to look at that and say, hey, look, this is not, doesn't look clean to me. And so therefore we're not going to lend on it. And so you want to look at 3 years because it's going to show that trend. You want the trend to be consistently going up. You can have years where it might be flat and then you want to see it continually then pop up and going in an overall trending upward projection. And you want the same thing, the cash flow, to mirror what's happening on the gross. Now, it's not all the time. There's always explanations for little things here and there, but that's generally what you want to see.
Do you start with the business? And this is what I just wrote in my notes. Do you start with the business and then back the industry into it? Or do you start with the macro industry and then back the business into it?
So always, okay. So for instance, definitely if a construction company came up to me, I'm looking at the macro in terms of, okay, who's your customers? Where, how are you making your money? And they tell me, oh, it's new construction. At that point, I'm just ending the conversation. So certain industries, it can go from macro into micro. But for most of the time, I'm focusing on the business. They come to me and they want to sell because we do a lot of our deals potentially off market. And we'll also work with listed deals as well. So we're really trying to dive into the 3 main questions. Why are you selling this business? Right? I love to hear the term retirement because that's great.
So divorce, why are you, distress.
Yep. Was that?
death, divorce, or distress for
real estate. Exactly. And the 3 D's there. And so you want to hear retirement. The next thing I'm asking is this financeable? Or do you know if it's financeable? Would there be any reason why it's not, right? And they might not know sometimes. You have to do some work. And the third one is going to be, what do you do on a daily basis? So I'm talking to the owner. I want to know how many hours a week are they working and what are the tasks that they're doing? And the ones that I'm interested in is the owner is working less than 20 hours a week and they're focusing on tasks that are very much admin type of tasks, right? They're not installing the HVAC system. Like that's not what they're doing. They're doing things that are very easily going to be replaceable by somebody else, not things that are very specific and require expertise. So those are the first three questions. If they answer those correctly, then at that point, we're getting under NDA and I'm asking for financials. And then we start going into the due diligence process on that.
Yeah. There's two red flags that have really come up when we're underwriting businesses. And the two red flags that have come up for us are, especially right now, specifically when you're underwriting a business and they don't properly label their, the PPE loan or like the COVID payouts. Yeah. All of a sudden you see this spike in revenue and then that's mislabeled. It may not be intentional. Sometimes it may be. And they count it as gross revenue, but then you have to go back and really dig and make sure you're like, okay, is this actually booked revenue or is just handouts? And then also when you have the owner not properly, to your point that you just made, not properly putting that salary on the expense sheet. So they're saying, okay, yeah, I've run this business, blah, 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 but you're not accounting for, okay, this position is going to cost me $120,000 to replace. Because that's really important. So those are two that we're running into. What are some other underwriting snafus that you guys are running into?
Yeah, great. You mentioned two good ones. One of the other ones that I always tell people to be aware of is when there's a lot of ad backs that they're trying to put into business, right? For instance, and for everyone out there, an ad back is, so a business will say that they're making $300,000 in SDE, seller discretionary earnings. So that's not only the income that they pay themselves as a salary, but it's also distributions. Going back to seller discretionary earnings, that's salary, that's distributions, and then something called ad backs. Those are things in which the business owner was using the business to pay for personal expenses. And they take those expenses and they can add them back. That's what they call ad backs to what they're saying the net profit is, right? So if they were using it to pay their car lease payment, they were using it to pay their cell phone bill, take vacations that were personal, they would then add all that up and say, okay, this extra $25K that I spent on myself shouldn't have been the business expense. That was personal expense. So therefore it's income. And they put that on top of the number. Mm. And so whenever I see a lot of those to where it's like, and 25,000 would actually be a little ad back. So I've seen deals where they try to throw $180,000 of ad backs back onto to say, oh, that's actually profit. And therefore our multiple should be including that, which is going to make 3X that number. And now you've added another $300,000, $400,000, $500K to the price. And so that goes on all the time. And so then you have to really go line by line. Is this really an ad back? Was this something that actually benefited the business, but they also got personal benefit out of it? How do you divide that? And so that when I see something that's very heavy in ad backs, I automatically get suspicious. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to go through it. And a lot of times if I see that, I'll just walk away and say, I'm just not going to go through
it. I'm guilty of that 100%.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a question that I asked John, because like when you run your own business, it becomes a question of how much profit do we make versus how much profit do we want to show?
Exactly. You know?
And then do you need to have that new Range Rover? Or was that just like that extra tax liability or that tax write-off? You know what I mean? I completely get what you're saying there. That's really interesting. So look at the ad backs. Dude, there's so many different ways I want to take this. Off-market versus brokers. When you're doing your acquisition, you said that you're a combination of the both. So where's most of your deal flow coming from? Off-market or
brokers are still going to be the majority. Off-market is always something to, because when you do an off-market deal, like in real estate, off-market real estate, you have a much higher chance of it being a good deal in terms of your return. You're going to get it for a better price, but you're going to put in a lot of effort. So you're now the one leading the dance. And so there's no broker that kind of help guide this transaction along. You're going to have to basically tell the seller exactly how this works and bring them through the process, get them to help them create these reports. A lot of these sellers don't have their financials in order. So it's a lot of waiting. It's a lot of coaxing. Takes way longer normally because it just takes a lot more time to get these people ready to sell. And just as you just mentioned with the ad backs, every business owner does that. It's not wrong. right? There's actual within
it's just
the
them
tax
trying to juice it, though.
Correct. Exactly. So yeah. As the buyer, though, if you're going to be selling your business, the way you run your business, especially for the last few years, has to be different. You have to make it completely clean and easy to understand. Otherwise, you run into someone like me on the other end who's, dude, this makes no sense. I have no idea what's good for the business or not good for the business. And so now I'm going to offer you way less money than the business might actually be worth because I just can't tell the difference between the two. Right?
So you have to pay your taxes.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. And that's what it took me a full year to understand that. Where it's just, hey, if there ever comes a point where you are looking to sell, like at least make sure that you're paying, like you're going to pay 2 years of heavy taxes. Before you even think about, because that's the cleaning process. It's you're taking it, you're making the books super clean. You're not doing those ad backs because that's just at the last second trying to juice that multiple, right?
Correct. Yep.
So I completely get what you're saying, dude. That's so useful. Here's a good question that nobody talks about. So you get a bunch of people and you say, we're going to go buy our first business together. Yay. Everyone's so excited. And they're like, oh, I'm going to go talk to these brokers and let's go. And then all of a sudden the broker's, hey, can you hit me with a PFS? Or hey, yeah, immediately. Hey, and they start trying to, because the brokers have so many tire kickers. So what's some advice you can give to somebody on forming the initial relationship with a broker? Because sometimes you only have one or two killers in your market and you really want to make sure that you're getting good with them and you don't burn that bridge and look like a tire kicking rookie right out the gate. What are some good rules of thumb, some rules of engagement for forming these broker relationships?
Dude, you got some great questions. These are exactly the things that we go and we talk through on each of our
We're just Instagram gurus.
We're just a bunch of gurus that are being able to do that. Hold on one second, babe. I'm gonna pause this. I get it. I'm almost. We got a few minutes. Probably what, like 5 minutes left on this.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll come get her in about 5 minutes. I got my. You see, hi. This is my little daughter. She is now on the action here, and so yeah.
Hey.
I'll get her in about 5 minutes. We'll finish up.
All good. Sorry, we'll wrap this up.
No, you're good. Going back to the brokers. So that's one of the big questions that we always start off with our students, because you're right. If you ruin that first interaction, you're going to be just screwed when it comes to trying to get any more deals from that guy. So the way that you do it is you start off with one, coming up with a narrative on what is your story? Why you have to make like your elevator pitch. Why are you getting into this game? What do you bring to this? What are you looking for? Nothing's worth like to a broker's eyes or ears when someone comes to them and says, like, I don't know what I want. I just want to make money. And then to them, it's this guy's just wasting my time. But if you come to them and say, hey, I'm looking to buy a $1 to $2 million HVAC company in Georgia, and I want to acquire it in the next 6 months. And here's my experience that I think can lend to acquiring that type of business. They're going to be like, okay, this person knows what they want. They seem like they understand the running a business. Their expertise matches up with what's needed. Great. Let's take this guy on and I'm going to be sending him listings, right? So you want to have your story and your narrative put together and you want to be able to convey that in a couple sentences in a very convincing manner, who I am and why I'm doing this and why you need to help me. And if you do that, you're going to be above 95% of other people that the broker's talking to, and he's going to put you at the top of his list and not the list on the side of his desk as tire kickers and never getting back to them. So that's the main thing I tell people in that interaction.
Yeah. And then it's always a dance of what comes first, the chicken or the egg. It's okay, I want to get experience, but I don't have experience. And that's preventing me from getting experience. So what we talk about is we're like, hey, that's where partnerships come in. If you're looking to buy with somebody, then go partner up with somebody that owns 38 laundromats. You're like, hey, we own 38 laundromats. Yep. Here's our balance sheet. Here's what we've done. Here's the markets that we own in. You don't have any, but they do. So like we just borrow that experience. But I could do this for another 2 hours with you, and we'll do another episode or we can have you come speak to each other's communities, man. This is freaking awesome. You gotta get back to your kids. Where can people find out more about you and talk a little bit about your community?
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys can find me out on either Twitter or Instagram at BenKelly1, one spelled out O-N-E. And my community is called Acquisition Ace. And like I mentioned before, we have at this point over 350 people that are all on their way to acquiring their first business. We have people acquiring businesses now at this point every other week. We're having people close and it's a lot of fun. We do weekly live calls twice a week. You have access to me 24/7 within the community. We help you with funding. We help you with off-market sourcing.
All right, guys, Ben's camera just cut back off. So I'm going to give the pitch for him. He rocks. You should go look up that stuff, and we'll put his links in the show description. He just cut out again, but I'll give him the plug there. With that, this has been Ben and Brian with the Action Academy podcast.
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with the show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are 2 main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.